Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 14, Promised Prayers to Lord Krishna, text number 15. Tatcha jalastam tava sajagat vapu. Kemena dvishtam bhagavans tataiva. Kim vasu drishtam ridhi me tataiva. Kim no sapad yeva punarva drishti. Tat. That. Chet. If. Jalastam. Situated within the water. Tava, your, sat, real, jagat, shelter in the entire universe, vapu, the transcendental body, kim, why, me, by me, nadrishtam, was not seen, Bhagavan, O Supreme Lord, Tada Eva, at that very time, Kim, why, Va, or, Sudrishtam, perfectly seen, Riddhi, within the heart, May, by me, Tada Eva, just then, Kim, why, na, not, who, on the other hand, sapati, suddenly, eva, indeed, puna, again, yadarshi, was seen. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada's disciples. My dear Lord, if your transcendental body, which shelters the entire universe, is actually lying within the water, then why were you not seen by me when I searched for you? And why, although I could not envision you properly within my heart, did you then suddenly reveal yourself? Purport. Brahma here refers to his experience at the dawn of cosmic creation. As described in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Brahma took birth on the seat of a giant lotus whose stem emanated from the navel of Narayana. Brahma was bewildered as to his whereabouts, function, and identity, and therefore he tried to trace out the source of the lotus stem, searching for clear information. Unable to find the personality of Godhead, he returned to his seat and engaged in severe austerities, having been ordered to do so by the transcendental voice of the Lord, who could be heard but not seen. After long meditation, Brahma saw the Lord, but then again lost sight of him. Thus, Brahma concludes that the transcendental body of the personality of Godhead is not material, but rather an eternal spiritual form endowed with inconceivable mystic potencies. In other words, Lord Brahma should not have challenged the personality of Godhead, the Lord of all mystic power. Translation again. My dear Lord, if your transcendental body, which shelters the entire universe, is actually lying within the water, then why were you not seen by me when I searched for you? And why, though I could not envision you properly within my heart, did you then suddenly reveal yourself? So even Brahma has problems with his mind. What to speak of our poor selves? The difference is that Brahma, he can meditate for hundreds and thousands of years and finally control his mind enough to think about Krishna. We don't have 100,000 years to do that. But the austerity in this age, because in every age there's some kind of austerity, the chanting of the holy names is sufficient if it's done in this proper mood. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains what is the process of naturally thinking about Krishna. Of course, it is not that we force Krishna into our consciousness, but what will attract Krishna to appear there? Now, Brahma, at the beginning of creation, didn't know what was going on. There was no one to instruct him except for the Lord within the heart. And the Lord only told him two words, tapa. But that was sufficient for Lord Brahma. Krishna didn't have to speak the entire Bhagavad Gita to Brahma, because Brahma, after hearing tapa, didn't look it up in the internet, because there was no internet, to find out what is he talking about. Why is he asking me to perform austerity? Who is this person anyhow? What's going on here? What does tapa mean? No, he immediately understood, because he's Brahma. And therefore he sat on his lotus flower and tried to fix his mind upon Krishna for a long, long time. Now we need a lot more instruction, because we're more confused than Brahma. And we don't have the same amount of intelligence. Therefore we have so much philosophy, so that one day we can just chant Hare Krishna happily and reach the perfection of life. Instead, we have so many things to worry about. Therefore, we could not sit on a lotus flower for more than 5 minutes without getting agitated, going for a swim in the Garbhodaka Ocean, relieve our distressed minds. We can't conceive of sitting anywhere, even to sit in a class for another 15 minutes. Sometimes it's torture for our poor minds. He might even tell us something that we don't like, and then our false ego will be very disturbed. So Brahma was advanced enough, but still he had to sit on a lotus flower for literally hundreds and thousands of years before Krishna appeared within his consciousness. In other words, it took him that long for Krishna to appear. Now, how can we have Krishna appear a little bit quicker? So therefore Krishna says, that's what Bhagavad Gita is all about. How Krishna could actually be manifest within our consciousness, called Krishna consciousness, without having to wait from another 100,000 births. And the first business is to find out that there's everything here belongs to Krishna. Because that's why we're an illusion. That's the main illusion, is that we don't see how Krishna's proprietor of everything. Therefore, we assume that what's within our influence is ours, to do with as we like. Therefore, our minds are always agitated by the three modes of material nature, trying to figure out what to do with what we have, or what to get that we don't have, or what unfortunate thing caused our lack or our loss of things in the past. So our minds are always agitated about the future and about the past, and dissatisfied with the present, because what we have is not sufficient, we think. And indeed, in the material world, whatever we're hankering for will never make us happy, as it didn't in the past make us happy. And whatever we have now won't make us happy either, because it's never made us happy. But what we need is Krishna. In other words, Krishna being the reservoir of pleasure, anyone who comes in actual contact with Krishna becomes full of pleasure. As Krishna has unlimited pleasure, so the little tiny soul can experience unlimited pleasure in contact with Krishna. But the problem is that we don't like Krishna. What to speak of chanting Hare Krishna feelingly or lovingly, we don't even like him because we're in competition with him. Bhayam dvitiya bhina neshitasya ishadabhatasya viparyos mriti. We're fearful because we identify ourselves with this body. And anyone who isn't fearful, who identifies themselves with their body, is either crazy or foolish. Or a combination of both. So, bhayam dvitiya vininashitasyat, this fear is arising because of our identification with this body. And we're forced to identify ourselves with this body because we're in competition with Krishna, trying to see who's the Lord of what we're survey, they say, or what we're within our influence. So that seems rather unfair. Poor soul, just trying to become a Lord like Krishna, and he's put into illusion. Because the fact is, the soul can't be a Lord of material nature, it's just not possible, because he has nothing to do with material nature. And nor is the material nature exactly what we think it is, something substantial. The material nature is more or less a conception that we have, the wrong conception. In one sense, as it will be explained in the Bhagavatam, the material nature is the dream of Mahavishnu. It's his energy, and it's arranged in such a way as to appear to be substantial. Substantial in the sense that it's going to last for some time, and it's actually something that could be enjoyable, or that we can actually experience perpetually as something enjoyable. There is enjoyment in the material nature, because there are senses and there are sense objects, and there is an experience, but it's only temporary, and it's incomplete and limited. We may get some flavor from eating a strawberry, but it doesn't last very long. And we want another strawberry, but we have a limited capacity for eating strawberries. And similarly, there's probably limited strawberries within our realm of ability to eat. Therefore, we're disappointed. If we like something and we want more of it, we can only get so much of it. And even when we get unlimited amounts of it, we can only utilize so much of it. And therefore, our ability to experience that happiness we originally experienced is rather limited. And therefore, it's frustrating. We're separated from the source of happiness in the material world constantly. And therefore, most of the material world is just hankering or imagining some situation where we actually be happy. And even if we find ourselves in a situation where we're happy, it's only temporary. Like in the heavenly planets, where people live for a long time, there's more of an illusion of being happy because their desires are fulfilled much more rapidly and much more readily and in much more abundance than they are here. So there's no anxiety not fulfilling our desires. Here we're wondering if I'm ever going to fulfill my desires. And therefore the desires, which themselves are not very pleasant, because Krishna says desires are avritam jnana etena jnanino nityavarina kamarupena kuntiya duspraena analena cha. That's a man's pure consciousness is covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire. So no amount of trying to gratify our senses, they become gratified. It's not that the senses, we wake up one day and they say, my dear soul, you've been working so hard, you worked so hard yesterday, so today we're going to give you some break. You don't have to sleep today. You don't have to eat anything. There will be no thoughts of sense gratification, and everyone will be your friend. There won't be any fear. Take a break for a day, or maybe two. You deserve it. No, we wake up every day, and it's another struggle. We don't know exactly what the struggle is going to bring, whether we're going to be successful or not. And of course, at the end of the struggle, we die. We struggle hard throughout one life, a lifetime, to avoid death, principally, and then we die anyhow, no matter how good we are at the struggle. And obviously, since we've been practicing since time immemorial to avoid death, no one has made any progress. Even Brahma has to die, but to speak of our poor selves. Therefore, our first business is to understand how powerful Krishna is, how it's his material energy, and therefore we're obliged to utilize it in his service, according to his direction. Unless we understand that it's all Krishna's energy, unless we understand that there is a Krishna who actually everything belongs to him, not just theoretically, but practically, so we can utilize it in Krishna's service, then there's no escape from Maya, from illusion of identifying ourselves with this body. Now, we may not think it's a big deal. So what if I identify myself with my body? I have a beautiful body. It's wonderful. It's growing younger all every day. It's just full of pleasure. Even when I step on a nail, I enjoy it. So we may think like that. And therefore we think, well, what's the sense of getting out of this illusion? I have a good illusion. The only reason why you want to get out of illusion is that your illusion is not so good. It's not like mine. Therefore, such people will never get out of illusion because they don't think they're an illusion. They think anyone who thinks that they're an illusion must be an illusion. And although they may be presented with the philosophy that your body's changing, they don't accept it. They think, this body is me. And I was, even the baby body was me, and I'm this body too. It makes no difference what the body looks like or what it can do. It's still me. It's always me. It just looks a little different. So they can't accept the fact that the body's changing, but they themselves are the same. And therefore, with a little bit of intelligence, one can understand that I'm not the body. I'm the person who's perceiving the body. I'm the living person, the conscious person, who's now conscious of an ever-changing body. But neither the body nor the material energy in which we're situated is conscious. You could try to talk to the wall, but if the wall talks back to you, then you're really in trouble. If you have a conversation every day with a wall, and you think you're developing a relationship with the wall, then you're in a really difficult situation. So most intelligent people realize that there is a difference between the people and the living entities who are moving, and this wall. Now you may kick the wall won't complain. Your foot may complain, but the wall won't complain. But if you kick a person, or even try to step on an ant, it won't be very happy, it'll complain. Because it has consciousness. The floor, even the own body that we have, our body has no consciousness. If you cut off your arm, which we don't recommend, then you'll notice that the arm has no consciousness. The arm will not ask to be put back. Wait a second, I like being part of you. Please put me back. Because the body is just a machine. It has no consciousness. But the person within the body, ourselves, we have consciousness, and therefore will feel bad that I'm missing, the body is missing its arm, because they'll limit what I can do in this world as being identified with the material, gross and subtle material body. But in any case, since we're conscious, we have the ability to desire, and because we have the ability to desire, we can desire either to try to make a happy situation in the material world, which begins with trying to make a permanent situation. Because Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says you can't be happy unless you're peaceful. If you're given a very nice meal the day before you're going to be executed, the meal doesn't taste as good as it should be, because we'll be in anxiety. Similarly, because we're misidentified ourselves with this temporary body, we're always in anxiety, and therefore nothing can make us actually happy. And for that reason, people take intoxication to try to forget reality. They sometimes claim that the devotees are escapists. They're trying to escape reality. Of course we're trying to escape reality. We're trying to get out of this bodily conception of life. Because we know the reality is that this material world is not meant for our happiness. It's meant to inspire us to get out of it. And those who don't want to escape reality, who want to immerse themselves in the material energy, generally speaking, they find a very unpleasant circumstances, including old age, disease, and death, and then having to take birth again. And so in order to avoid the unpleasant consequences of accepting this reality as real, therefore they take so much intoxication just to forget all their problems. But that's not the solution to their problem, because after the intoxication goes away, again they have even more problems. So the conclusion is, first of all, we have to understand that we're eternal, and that our real success in life is to realize we're eternal, free from all fear. And beyond that success is to realize the Supreme Person who's controlling everything. After all, if all these living entities are all an illusion, how did that happen? There must be, and if some living entities are not an illusion, how do they get out of illusion? How do they realize that they're eternal? And even every religion, there's always saintly persons who have more or less realized they're eternal. Like there was one saint in the Christian tradition, and he was being tortured by the Romans. So they had this kind of wok. A wok is like where they cook things. So they put him on the wok, and they were going to cook him. So while they were cooking him on the wok, he said, actually, this side is already well done. Maybe you should turn me over. So he was obviously not in the bodily concept of life. Similarly, when Socrates was being poisoned by hemlock, they said, now we're going to get you. So Socrates said, no, first you have to catch me before you can get me. In other words, he didn't think he was his body. They were poisoning his body, but that had nothing to do with his real self. He'd simply go somewhere else after this body became, he couldn't use it anymore. So first thing is to accept our position as eternal souls, to realize that without taking shelter of Krishna, we can't realize it, nor can we permanently, even if we realize we're eternal, we can't permanently stay out of Krishna's maya unless we recognize Krishna as a proprietor. And the next thing is that we have to sincerely inquire how to utilize the energies I have already and utilize them in Krishna's service. Because everyone has different energies, different desires, but how to properly utilize them in Krishna's service so that we're actually engaged in what Krishna wants us to do. Then if we could do that, that relies upon Paramatma. And Paramatma is represented externally as Shastra, Guru, and Sadhu. So to take shelter of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, and realize the message of Paramatma within our heart, then we can understand what to do. And if we do that sincerely to please Krishna, then automatically we'll remember Krishna. Automatically Krishna will appear within our memory. Because Krishna says that. If we do, we utilize his energies to please him, then he'll appear within our heart to accept our service, which is basically love, the desire to please Krishna. Krishna will appear there to accept that service of trying to please him. And the result is we get Krishna's association. And although Krishna is pleased by our effort to please him, we're much more pleased by experiencing Krishna's presence, free from the desire to lord all the material nature and speculation what to do in this world to make ourselves happy. Because we understand that there's nothing to gain here, there's nothing to lose, that Krishna is our friend and guide and will tell us how to utilize his energies whenever we ask him. And by doing that to please him, then Krishna actually becomes pleased by our desire to please him. Our desire to please him is actually our natural position. It's our spiritual energy. That's who we are. That's what we're made of, a desire to please Krishna. That's our normal position. And then we experience Krishna's desire or love to please everyone, and we become very happy. We become conscious of Krishna. So Brahma did that after many thousands of years. We just have to say Hare Krishna and be sincere. Be sincere means that when we're saying Hare Krishna, we're not speculating about a million things that we want to do today and all the bad things that happened yesterday and what could happen tomorrow, which might be good or bad. It means just chant Hare Krishna happily and realize we have nothing to do with the material world. The material world is simply an opportunity to serve Krishna. And if we're going to chant Hare Krishna and serve him properly, we just have to chant nicely and not worry about anything. And then if we remember Krishna, then we can understand that we're making some progress. We're going in the right direction. That's called Krishna consciousness. And that's what this process and all this philosophy is about. Just to become conscious of Krishna by following this simple process called devotional service. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. What help us to be aware every day that practically everything belongs to Krishna, not just theoretical?
Well, the more we utilize things in Krishna's service, the more we become experienced. The more we can understand how we're connected to Krishna, because we're able to utilize things in Krishna's service because we've been instructed by Krishna externally in terms of his representatives, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. And we're reminded by Krishna within our heart. And when we serve him like that and we remember Krishna, then we experience some happiness. So therefore that happiness creates a desire within us to get more happiness by following the same process. So basically speaking, if we learn to do things nicely for Krishna and Krishna is pleased with us and we feel some transcendental happiness, then the result is we're inspired to get more of it. But if we don't understand properly, or if we don't follow the process as it is and we don't get the happiness, then we won't continue doing it. It's all based upon experiencing a higher taste, as Krishna says. We may not be overwhelmed with transcendental ecstasy and roll on the ground, but just a little relief from our distress, a little bit further understanding of who we actually are what's going on here and the process of what is our real goal of life, that in itself is encouraging to follow the process. It's certainly a better conception than work hard throughout your whole life, grow old, get disease, and then die and not know where you're going. If someone finds that enlivening, then they probably won't be attracted to Krishna consciousness. They think, wow, I just can't wait till I suffer and die. They probably would be very much interested in becoming happy and blissful by following the process of Krishna consciousness. Anything else?
Thank you. I already got the answer, but I have another question. I would like to know your opinion about deceased souls. You know, I once came across a person who was a channel, and he gave me some messages from deceased souls, and I got those messages, but I'm still unsure if this is Krishna or this is fake. What is your opinion?
Did the deceased souls advise you to chant Hare Krishna?
No.
Oh.
No. That was my own decision. But, you know, I'm interested in if that person was Krishna conscious or is that a fake thing that he can channel messages?
I mean,
what do you think?
There are souls who are in subtle bodies, who didn't get a gross body. Sometimes people can channel them. But what's the use? When they were alive, they said nonsense. And when they left their bodies, they're still saying nonsense.
Yeah,
I mean, there are people who can do that. But what's the value?
So that was something that was really divine. It wasn't.
Could be. Not everyone who claims to be a channeler is actually channeling.
But
they could be channeling their own imagination.
Do you think that if I feel myself that was true,
yeah,
maybe.
But it would be good if who they're channeling gives you some actually good instruction. Otherwise, what's the value? There's so many people you could talk to.
It was a good instruction.
Oh, then that's good. So.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Anything? Someone else had a question? Yes.
Thank you for inspiring lecture. I would just like to ask if sometimes happens that we don't like some inspiration, how can we even then if we don't accept happiness, how can we even then enthusiastically continue with the process?
Well, if you have no inspiration, how can you enthusiastically continue? You have to get inspiration. So when we don't feel we're inspired, we have to read Prabhupada's books or chant Hare Krishna. We have to do something that will give us some inspiration. Krishna says, that which in the beginning is bitter like poison, but at the end is just like nectar, and awakens one to self-realization, is said to be happiness in the mode of goodness. So sometimes there'll be experiences where we feel bitter like poison, but then we have to take the process. Prabhupada gives the example of Rupa Goswami gives the example of sugar candy. When you have sugar candy, when you have jaundice, you know what jaundice is? When you eat sugar candy, which is sweet, it tastes bitter. But it's not that the sugar candy is bitter, it's just that that's our experience because we're diseased. But if one takes the sugar candy regularly when it's medicinally treated or whatever, then the result is that eventually our disease becomes cured, and then we can understand how sweet the sugar candy actually is. So sometimes we may be in the wrong state of consciousness, but then we have to do what will bring us into a better state of consciousness. Prabhupada defines enthusiasm in the nectar of instruction, at endeavors performed with intelligence in Krishna consciousness, it's called enthusiasm. So we have to add those things together. We We have to do what Krishna wants with intelligence, and we have to become Krishna conscious, and then we'll experience enthusiasm. All right. Vala, Grantharashimad Bhagavatam Kijai.